bring that up. The SAV update, we're going to break for lunch at 12:15. And the bottom line was, no, what I was going to do, Bob, quite honestly, is leave it up to you as to where you wanted to go, now or later.
I'm going to do it now.
You got it.
And I'm on a roll, and I'm going to do my best to keep this going. I'm going to start right with here, where we started off.
I will tell you this, that I have to leave here just for about 5 minutes at noon. I want you to know not to rush you, that I read your report. I know the work you do, and you send me brief updates from time to time. I don't want you to think the fact that I'm leaving at noon for 5 minutes has anything to do with the importance of this presentation.
I mean, I could put all of you on my little email list when I talk about Seagrass if you want to hear about it.
I think
I'm going to turn the lights off just very quickly.
Thank you.
Several years ago, we identified propeller scarring as a big issue within the Chesapeake Bay now. And in the late 90s, we conducted a very intensive study in which we identified a number of locations that had large numbers of propeller scarring. And again, the propeller scarring in seagrass beds can be viewed from even low level when you see these white lines going through the seagrass. And they are definitely due to propellers. And we identified the fishing practice of halting as being the primary mode of seagrass loss for the scars. And again, the dominant areas where the people have hauled, we've worked with them, came up with some very interesting regulations about improving haul seining. But again, we requested VMRC to allow us to continue to monitor at least two sites within the Chesapeake Bay for haul seining, propeller scarring issues, and recovery. One in the Mobjack Bay, we call it the Browns Bay site. A second called the Pocosin site. Now, what you're looking at is a composite of a number of aerial photographs in which all these little different color lines, and this is something I've showed earlier, where we map every single scar using geographic information system methods over a time period of 89 through 2001. In previous presentations, we documented how quickly some of these areas did recover, and these are the data that we update now regularly. And what you're looking at, scar length, total number of scar meters. So if you look at every one of these lines, we take the number of meters and add them up. And what we did with some field work, for example, this site, these are the number of linear meters of scars formed in 1991 that you could see in 1992 photography. We found that those scars recovered very quickly when there was a lot of grass, and so within 3 to 5 years, a lot of the scars that we identified for a particular year were, we called, recovered, both from the way we map in our photography and also in the field. Again, as you can see, the linear amount of scarring has been decreasing, and over the last few years for the Browns Bay has declined to much less than what we saw historically. And, of course, this is the time period that really raised our awareness to it, but the numbers of scars have decreased. So in 2005, the update over 2004, only 85 meters of new scars did were we able to detect in this area, and a total of 3,450 meters. That's all the scars that we could see in the photography compared to the 2004 numbers. So that's the Browns Bay intensive site. And these are the scars where they occur in the Browns Bay area. So all those blue lines are all the scars that occurred in 2005 or where we monitor them from previous years, which you know, some of them are recovering. The Pocosin Flats area, which is just above the Back River area by Nassau Langley, again, the same thing, a composite of several pictures in which all of the scars for this time period were mapped. And, of course, some have recovered, but it showed the intensity of the scars in certain points of these grass beds, which were here and here. The data for 2005 versus 2004, we did note quite a few more scars in 2005 compared to 2004, and that's the total went up. So there has been some additional activity that's resulting in more scars in the Pocosin Flats compared to Browns Bay, which we think may be due to the fact that there was one more haul center in the Pocosin Flats area. And I maintain regular contact with one of the haul centers, Mr. Nathan Dryden, We've talked regularly over many years, and just recently I told him of what we were going to present today and of our concern, and he thinks that perhaps one of the other hall centers that is new to the area may be the person creating these problems. And he said he would be willing to talk to him in lieu of us really kind of saying, hey, we got a problem here. Perhaps they might be able to resolve the problem internally.
Well, along that same lines, if you can notify Colonel Rhodes of what you find out, you know, a lot of what law enforcement does is not necessarily punitive in nature. We like to educate as well. So if you can let us know what's going on there, if it's a...
Yeah. You know, and like I said, I talked to Nathan the other day. I told him I was coming here, and I told him what we found, and I said, listen, you know, this is the problem, you know, and he said he would talk to the gentleman.
Great. Thank you.
And again, those are where the scars occurred again, and, you know, these regions around the points of land where hall setting usually does occur. So our conclusions, basically the fact that in Pecosin Flats we saw more scarring in 2005 than 2004, a reverse of what we saw the previous year, but it's certainly a lot less than what we have seen historically. And that, again, the changes that were made in 2004, I think, have helped. There's an increased awareness of seagrass. I know that law enforcement certainly has been very good in working with us and trying to help out where they can, you know, given limited funds and the other things that you have to deal with these past years. And again, the recommendations are very similar to last year. We want to continue monitoring these scars. We want to provide you with an update of what we see on an annual basis. So the next one would be 2007, and hopefully your support for monitoring the direct impacts, which are going to be important in my next presentation about what's going on with eelgrass in the lower bay. So that's where we are with an update in the propeller scarring.
All right.
And we do look bay-wide. I mean, it's not just these two sites. We do monitor what's going on in the other areas, but these areas were the ones with the most intense activity.
Thank you.
Okay, in terms of the die-off, and I'll answer any questions when I finish up both presentations. Okay, in 2005, we noted during the summer a massive die-off of eelgrass, which can be depicted in this particular picture. These are low-level color shots that shows a grass bed in the Little Animessex River in Maryland. It's the best one that we have. We have others, but I just want to show you one. This is a dense grass bed that was present in June of 2005. In December, there was basically no eelgrass left. And this was true throughout the Chesapeake Bay in 2005, a massive, massive die-off. We did not see this massive die-off in the coastal bays, which was really kind of interesting because it really helped us try to better understand what happened in 2005. In terms of the recovery, not only do we have the bay-wide survey, but in response to this, we have established permanent small quadrants throughout the bay, as noted by the yellow dots. Every one of those dots is a permanent site that we went to this current year where we have established a quadrant that we will go back to. We sample one quadrant. We have another quadrant we go back to in 2007 in terms of monitoring what's going on with eelgrass. And these green triangles represent transects where we actually make measurements along a line that's strung out from the shore in terms of better understanding the whole dynamics of that bed that matches up with our aerial photography. And again, for those that don't know this, we monitor every single bed every year and produce a report that shows where all the grass beds are throughout the Chesapeake Bay, regardless of whether they're eelgrass or other submersed aquatics. So we have a pretty comprehensive bay-wide coverage of these areas that have eelgrass. And you'll see some systems like the Rappahannock don't have any squares or triangles or whatever. That's because there's almost no eelgrass anymore in the Rappahannock River. That was lost in 72 after Tropical Storm Agnes. Same thing within the Piankatank River. Very little eelgrass left in the Piankatank. And again, those losses occurred in 1972 or just after 1972's Tropical Storm Agnes storm. Just quickly, let me show you from one site right here where we monitor these grass beds with these transects right here, like lines that go across the grass bed, in particular this one line, just to show you what happened on the ground. This is percent cover of plants that are measured in individual little plots along a distance from shore in 2004, 2005. In 2004, you can see the coverage in some of these spots was 100%. And through October, which represents the time period in which eelgrass has lost a lot of leaves, a natural process, that next year in 2005 along that transect, there was almost, well, actually there were a few shoots, but essentially no eelgrass left. And again, this really raised the heightened our awareness of what the heck is going on. We looked specifically at water temperature, and we looked at a time period that I have in this block for 2004 and 2005 compared to the average 1997 through 2003 for those two sites in the York River, where we have continuous recorders. And if you note very quickly that in 2005, during this critical time period for both sites, the temperature was significantly higher in 2005 compared to 2004, and consistently higher than the summer average between 1997 and 2003. If you looked in particular at that time period that I highlight in the box, the yellow represents the amount of time the temperatures were above these temperatures, and this little area right here above 30 degrees centigrade, which is, I think, 86 degrees Fahrenheit. For 2005, the temperatures were roughly 30% above that, 30% above 30 degrees centigrade for this time period, and compared to like 5% for 2004. We really believe temperature in 2005 just was off the board and lethal for most of the eelgrass beds in the Chesapeake Bay. We did look at turbidity, and these are, again, continuous measurements. It's a lot of scatter, but the bottom line is when we did the analysis comparing 2004-2005 versus 1997-2003 average for this particular site where we have a lot of continuous data, the turbidity readings between those 2 years were not significantly different. So we don't think turbidity was a major factor. And the recovery, we have seen recovery. Just to let you know, we are watching what's going on. Here's the 2006 data for that same site, and you can see that the grass beds in those areas have indeed been recovering based on the percent cover along that same transect. So bottom line is there has been some recovery. Conclusions, very simply, that in 2005, all the eelgrass beds died, or most of them. The die-off, we believe, was related to the higher frequencies of water temperatures in July and August of 2005 compared to 2004. Turbidity level, we don't think, was a problem. There has been some recovery in 2006 to pre-die-off abundances, but not every single area. Here are the key points. And again, from people who like to deal with horticulture, recovery has been largely through seedlings. And I'm going to get to that point in my major issues approaching us for 2007. And fortunately, despite our hot July, and many of you knew how hot it was in July, some recent censuses around the bay showed that the beds that have been recovering are fortunately still doing okay, and we may have dodged the bullet as temperatures have dropped back to about normal for this time of year. Our major issues for 2007, first, seedlings of eelgrass do not flower the first year. So there were almost no flowering shoots in many areas of the bay in 2006, meaning no seeds produced this year, so that many of these areas no longer have seeds. If we had a major die-off, we would be looking at catastrophic losses of seagrass, eelgrass, in the Chesapeake Bay. Thank goodness there was success so far with the seedlings. We expect these plants to flower in the second year, 2007, and hopefully having a good seed crop. But again, because the size of these beds are not what we saw in 2005, we're not sure of the total seed effort, and we're saying every seed's going to count. These seeds are important, as I make a note here in point two. They're really important for the creation of new patches or bed recovery, in particular in areas that, let's say, have had cow nose ray disturbance or this massive die-off. Had it not been for seeds, we wouldn't have any eelgrass in 2006. The last 2 points, the existing grass beds that we've got, we're going to have to really watch them carefully, monitor them, and work with you all in terms of how do we really improve conservation of these beds. You know, these beds are much reduced from what we saw 40 years ago, and we have seen even some decadal changes in the last 10 years, in which I want to highlight here. Again, from our aerial survey, I'm going to show you three sites, Goodwin Island, York River, Guinea Marsh, Allen's Island. These are the grass beds in the York River, Goodwin Island side here. These are grass beds in 1996. This is what we got left in 2000. This is 1996. This is what's left in 2006. Far different in terms of overall grass abundance from 10 years ago. Here's Allen's Island, which is in the lower York River near Vims. Vims is down here. You can note here, again, from this aerial photo, that these are dense grass beds on this side of Allen's Island in 1996. By 2006, significant reductions in eelgrass on this side of the island. And the Guinea Marsh area, which is the mouth of the York River, abundant grass beds along this big shoal, and this is what we've got left of 2006. So there have been some significant changes which concern us, and I'm just letting you know we're watching this. We have some notion that Isabel played a role in some of this, but there's some other factors that are going on that may be related to global warming. Since 1996, five of those last 10 years have been the hottest years on the surface of the Earth. Eelgrass is a cool-tempered species. We're at this, almost at the southern limit of its distribution. If we continue to have this global warming issue, we may be looking at, you know, potentially major, major losses of seagrass. And the things that we've talked about in the past about how they recover and the disturbances, I think we're going to have to watch this every single year to see what does happen. And we do think the seaside areas could be potentially more important because they are bathed by much cooler water, and which is why we think they made it through the 2005 die-off period that occurred in the bay. So those seaside beds could be particularly important because we actually went back to them to harvest some of the seas for our restoration work this year, which is ironic because that's how we established those beds for Chesapeake Bay. So we're now taking seas from those areas and using those for some of our recovery work in those areas. Okay, questions, and, you know, just we're going to be looking to you all for some guidance, too, on this. And how about that? I got it at 12 o'clock. I mean, I had a hard time culling a lot of slides because there's a lot of stuff going on, and we have a lot of data. But the bottom line is, as I try to make in my conclusion statements, big die-off, they've recovered, but, you know, we're not out of it yet. We've got to watch what happens, you know, the next few years.
Questions? Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Dr. Worth. What do you attribute the survival of the seedlings to in 2005 elevated water temperatures killed off all the mature plants?
Yeah, the seedlings, they're youthful. The sediments are very different because with the die-off that occurred in 2005, a lot of these areas, all the roots and rhizomes just got washed out. It's now clean sand. A lot of the organics that are in these sediments have been washed out. You know, I was out on Friday, and I wanted to go check a whole bunch of sites so that if I got this question, you know, I could perhaps respond in a reasonable and scientific fashion, but the rhizomes look very healthy, and I've never seen root hairs on these plants as healthy now as I have in the past. Those sediment conditions are important. Why they made it through the summer? I mean, again, these are the types of questions that, you know, we're asking ourselves, and I'm hoping we'll have some good answers. But it's, you know, the more we know about eelgrass, the more we find out how much we don't know. And, you know, we are in contact with people up and down the East Coast because, again, these plants grow throughout, and we're asking people to follow really carefully what's going on and what they see in their annual patterns. You know, we're just going to have to watch. And that's why we have all these permanent sites and transects set up. It's really important to not just do the aerial survey, but be on the ground with our face in the water and watching day in, day out what happens.
Thank you.
Clarity and turbidity, are they the same? You'll have to help me here, Dr. Worth.
Okay. Turbidity is color of water, and there are different components that contribute to it. One is silt and clay. The other is phytoplankton that adds some green. Turbidity is a combination of both. When we collect samples, we do partition that clarity into how much is due to dirt and how much is due to living matter. And in the coastal bays, a big chunk of the water clarity is actually due to suspended sediments, dirt. I mean, if you've been on the eastern shore of coastal bays, there's a lot of fine material. In the Chesapeake Bay, even watershed by watershed, that clarity changes. So in the James River right now, a significant amount of clarity is due to just dirt in the water column. And that can change. In the Potomac River, a significant amount of the clarity, the loss of light through the water column, occurs because of significant phytoplankton blooms, algae.
So can I have one follow-up question? That is, why did you rule out turbidity for these years in the demise of the
when we did the statistical analysis, there was no significant difference. And we had been monitoring water quality in the York River every 2 weeks since 1984. We know a lot about what goes on within the York River, which is where these data come from. And we looked really carefully at what could affect the grass the most. One was turbidity, but it's when it occurs. Usually during the summer, turbidity is fairly consistent in many of these areas. It's during the spring and fall where we see big differences, but that has always been a major issue for seagrasses, is how clear the water is. Now, there might be some interactions that are very subtle, because you've got to remember, just like you, these plants are out there day in, day out. We're out there every 2 weeks with a monitor, or we do have some continuous monitoring. These plants soak it up, and they're changing, second by second. It's possible that with those high temperatures, if the water was clearer, maybe we would have had a better success. But the bottom line is the temperatures in 2005, as I tried to show you, were off the board and at above the lethal range for eelgrass survival. The other thing about 2005, if you don't know, it was a very calm summer. There wasn't a lot of wind. It was significantly less windy. And that turbulence, in many times, stirs up the bottom and keeps things oxygenated. And in 2005, the summertime conditions, if you were a sailor, you would have known it very easily, how calm it was. Fortunately, 2006 looks like it's a little bit more windy.
Any other questions? If not, excellent report. We thank you.
Bob, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Chairman, before you move off this item.
Yes, sir.
There is a need to approve funding for Dr. Orth's proposal to continue this work for an additional year.
What's the proposal?
The proposal is to continue the monitoring of the scars at the two sites that he showed you. It's a request for $20,000, which would be split between the two license funds, commercial and recreational.
I think that based on the demonstrated importance of this work, and we all know from the work and the presentations, Bob, that you provided through the years that I've had the benefit of sitting and listening on the other side, eelgrass and water quality and all the habitat go hand in hand, and I think I would certainly support that. If I could get a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Holland.
I move that we continue the request for funding as made.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Robbins. Any further discussion to the motion? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Doctor. And really. Mr. Travelstead, you had some introductions that you would like to make?
We have.
Good to have you here today.
Thank you. We have two new members of the Fishery Management Division staff that have joined us in the last few weeks that I'd like to introduce to the commission. The first is Joe Griss. He is now our head of the Department of Fishery Planning and Statistics. He replaces Eric Robillard, who I think most of you knew, or the position was originally held by Roy Inslee. Joe comes to us from the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission staff, where he was a stock assessment specialist. Prior to that, he worked with the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries. He's a native of Newport News, has a degree from Christopher Newport University and a master's degree in fishery science from Virginia Tech. So we're very pleased to have him on staff. Brings a lot of new talent in areas that we previously did not have. The second new member is Mike Johnson, who is a fishery management planner. He fills Ellen Cosby's position. Ellen left to take a position with the Potomac River Fisheries Commission. Mike was previously with the Marine Biological Lab in Woods Hole and the National Marine Fisheries Service in North Carolina for 11 years, has a degree from the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and a master's degree in marine biology from UNC.
Thank you, Jack. I can tell you, after the introductions this morning, from an agency head perspective, I cannot be any more pleased with the caliber of candidates and employees that we're attracting. I swear, I don't mean anything to my predecessor, but I can't help but believe that we're as in good a shape as we possibly can. The good employees that we're attracting and the fine ones that we're retaining, I feel really comfortable from an agency head perspective and very pleased and welcome you. And if I can do anything to help you, just let me know. With that, lunch is not here. We're going to continue on with the agenda. Yeah.